Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Dennis, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so, of course, we'll be talking about Dr. Cuddy's latest article up at newswithviews.com. And if you don't go to News with Views every day, why, you need to. And about once every week or 2 weeks, why, Dr. Cuddy has an article posted there. And they're always important. You certainly, if you want to really know what's going on, you ought to pull down all of his articles, put them in a book, and loose-leaf book, and read them several times. I think they're vitally important to your understanding of what's going on. So, Dr. Cuddy, you go ahead and pick up the story.
Well, the title of this article that was posted this Monday is "What Is the Role of Iran?" Part 3. I had done parts 1 and 2 some time ago, but since there's a good deal of interest renewed in what Iran is up to these days, I thought I would continue that series. But as usual, I put a note at the first before the article begins, and the note is about something very contemporary in the news at the moment. And in this case, I was talking at first about the New York Times article called "China Urges New Money Reserve to Replace Dollar." And the reason I did that is in my previous article on another subject, I had mentioned Russia had suggested the same thing. So this is a continuation of this movement towards actually it'll be a global currency is what it will amount to. And the article began with the following quotation, quote, "In another indication that China is growing increasingly concerned about holding huge dollar reserves, the head of its central bank has called for the eventual creation of a new international currency reserve to replace the dollar," end quote. Now, that was March 24th, and then the next day, the London Telegraph published an article which was titled "U.S. Backing for World Currency Stuns Markets." And that article began with these words, quote, "U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner shocked global markets by revealing that Washington is quite open to Chinese proposals for the gradual development of a global reserve currency run by the International Monetary Fund. The dollar plunged instantly against the euro, yen, and sterling as the comments flashed across trading screens. David Bloom, currency chief at HSBC, said the apparent policy shift amounts to an earthquake in geo-finance. The mere fact, this is Bloom, the mere fact that the U.S. Treasury Secretary is even entertaining thoughts that the dollar may cease being the anchor of the global monetary system has caused consternation," end quote, Mr. Bloom said. And the article continues from the London Telegraph. "Mr. Geithner later qualified his remarks, insisting that the dollar would remain the world's dominant reserve currency for a long period of time. But," and the commentator writing this article in London Telegraph concludes by saying, "but the seeds of doubt have been sown," end quote.
Well, I think it's so important for our listeners to understand that Timothy Geithner is one of these people who has no loyalty to America. He's a member of the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, the Group of 30. He certainly comes from Kissinger Associates. And these, Henry Kissinger, of course, is the man who's really running things behind things, at least according to James Jones. I recently pulled out just today from the Council on Foreign Relations. James Jones' speech, you know, he's a member of the Trilateral Commission, as is Henry Kissinger, and James Jones simply said, "I take my orders every day from Henry Kissinger." Comes from the CFR website if you'd like to see it. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And Dr. Cuddy has certainly taught at the university level and certainly worked in the Reagan Department of Education, and he's testified before Congress. He's a prolific writer. And if you don't read his articles every day in the, pardon me, I should say every week at World Affairs Brief, you are missing something. But certainly Dr. Cuddy has simply started out our program talking about a report. It was just a little over a week, maybe 2 weeks ago, where the Secretary of the Treasury, Timothy Geithner, has actually come forward and suggested that the America would not be adverse to having another currency replace the dollar as the reserve currency. Now, for the average individual, that really means the destruction of everything you've worked for all of your life, and certainly your pensions, your insurance policies, everything that you've set aside, your bonds, they'll all be destroyed with a massive inflation that will come when the dollar is no longer the reserve currency of the world. The following day, Timothy Geithner said, well, I really didn't mean what I said, you know, dollar is going to be the major currency for a long period of time. But that's not true. Mr. Geithner is very, very close to the Chinese communists. He is part of this cabal that runs America, this secret little group. I call them the Brotherhood of Darkness, who hate America and are intent upon destroying this nation, but they're going to use our financial and military power as long as they can to bring about this one world government with the destruction of Christianity and the coming world religion. But pick up the story there, Dr. Cuddy.
Well, before I pick up the story, relevant to what you just said, isn't it interesting how these players just keep popping up with the same institutions? For example, when you're mentioning very close Geithner to the Chinese, the former Treasury Secretary Paulson had been with Goldman Sachs, who represented a large amount of Chinese interest here as well. Isn't that coincidental?
Yes, of course. They all belong to the same little club. Mr. Paulson's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers. Mr. Geithner's a member of the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Bilderbergers. And, of course, the faces change, but the policies really don't change. They always stay the same. Because, of course, the leaders of this country have no loyalty to this country, but to this internationalist dream, the one world government, the one world religion, the one world leader. Go right ahead.
And I think you just mentioned about Jones, and it takes his directions from Kissinger, and Geithner had been with Kissinger Associates. Remember, Brent Scowcroft was with Kissinger Associates, and wasn't the person in charge of the debacle, the sort of just accidental...
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest, of course, is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, certainly one of our good friends. And I went up on the Council on Foreign Relations webpage today and pulled out from the Council on Foreign Relations General James Jones' remarks at the Munich Security Meeting in February. Now, General James Jones, a four-star retired Marine general, he is the head of the National Security Council, one of the closest advisors to the President of the United States. He just happens by chance to be a member of the Trilateral Commission. His first assistant, Thomas Damelon, just happens to be a member of the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Bilderbergers. And, of course, but General Jones speaking there, and anybody would like a copy of this, I'll be glad to send it to you. And this is not what somebody read, put out on the Internet. This is what the Council on Foreign Relations says. General Jones got up, you know, and congratulated the people at this international meeting for their praise of Henry Kissinger, and he said, I take my orders every day from Henry Kissinger. We have a chain of command in the National Security Administration, and I get my orders regularly from General Brett Scowcroft and of course, from Sandy Berger, both of them Council on Foreign Relations, in and out of the Trilateral Commission. But isn't that interesting? The man, of course, who heads national security, closest advisor to the president, gets his advice every day from Henry Kissinger. Why, he was the man who, of course, controlled the The Nixon administration, he was his closest advisor to George Bush. George Bush would always demur to whatever Henry Kissinger wants, but it doesn't matter whether you're Democrat or Republican. Henry Kissinger is always there directing and orchestrating things from behind the scenes, spinning his web of control just like the Black Widow spider. But you go right ahead.
That's a good analogy. I remember about... It was about 15 years ago, I had a chart published in Dr. Shirley Carell's Pro-Family Forum. And it was a very large chart, and it had various institutions. And one of them was Kissinger Associates, and I was, you know, ticking off the people and what they had done who were with that group, and then Lehman Brothers and Lazard Frères, Lazard Brothers, and the Trilateral Commission, the World Bank, and so forth. And Kissinger and Associates is an interesting crew, like you just said. Geithner has been connected with them. And don't we remember the person who just happened to be in charge of the debacle in Iraq?
You mean Paul Bremer, yes. Of course.
Yeah.
He came from Kissinger and Associates.
Yeah.
He's the man who dissolved the Iraqi army, who dissolved the Iraqi police force, who dissolved the Iraqi civil service, who shut down all the factories so people would have no jobs, who
right.
closed down the hospitals and the schools, and then he wondered why there was chaos over there. Go right ahead.
That's right. No jobs, no nothing. Then he wonders what's the problem. Yeah, all of them just happen to be belong to Kissinger Associates. If your listeners want to, they can go on PBS's website and look at the Charlie Rose show and listen to his programs. They have them archived. And he had a couple of interesting interviews this week. On Tuesday was John Negroponte.
Incidentally, Charlie Rose comes from the Trilateral Commission. There's only about, 87 members here at the present time. Charlie Rose just happens to be one. Isn't that interesting? Framing our attitudes and, of course, calling in his other people from the Trilateral Commission to interview. But go right ahead.
And Charlie Rose is one of those who's been plucked. He comes from this tiny town, just about 30 miles north of where I live, a little town called Henderson. And his dad had Rose's sort of 5 and 10 stores. They would have little trinkets and items and so forth. And so little old Charlie just happens to wind up with his own show and is really, really close friends with all the movers and shakers in the world. And this is another instance why I had mentioned some interviews ago and some articles ago about certain individuals behind the scenes who are members of the power elite, and they have their agents. Kissinger is an agent of the power elite and so on. And one of the fellows I mentioned was a Burt Bennett, who pretty much runs things, although nobody's heard of him. And he's from this little place called Fefton. It's a funny sort of P-F-A-F-F-T-O-W-N, right outside of Winston-Salem, little town. And I won't belabor this, but the point is he is the person who literally creates these people. It's sort of like the Rockefeller, except this fellow, Burt Bennett, is the Royal Dutch Shell person who is a tremendous, just about as powerful, the House of Orange, the whole bit over there in Holland. And powerful just like the Rockefeller family, internationally, globally. And so he's their person. And I remember Hubert Humphrey, 1968, when he was running, somebody asked him, do you know Burt Bennett? And he said, this is the Vice President of the United States under Lyndon Johnson. You would think it's the most powerful man on earth, being President of the U.S., being a real arm twister in the Senate. Not that he was right about things, just he was very powerful. And Hubert Humphrey says Burt Bennett is the Lord God Almighty of politics. He didn't say Lyndon Johnson is, Khrushchev, whoever. He says this guy, who nobody has heard of and then and now. There are certain people, myself and others, who know this guy. In fact, a friend of mine who later became head of our Supreme Court here, I was having lunch with him. This is a digression, but it's important for your listeners to understand who these people are behind the scenes. I was having lunch with him downtown in a cafeteria, and we came together, we sat down, and he says, Dennis, just got a call the other day from Burt Bennett. I said, oh? He said, yeah, he wanted me to come up and see him. He was running for governor, and he knew that if he went and saw Burt Bennett, now Burt Bennett didn't come see him, this person running for governor of a very powerful family in the state. He was supposed to go see Brad Bennett. He said, "Dennis, I know what he wanted. You know, if I went to see him and got his blessing, I know that I would be governor. But I just can't do it. I'm just not going to do it." And I said, "Well, good for you." And later on, you know, of course, he didn't become governor. His opponent was chosen. But he did, you know, work his way up to be head of the Supreme Court of the state. But the point is, these are the guys behind the scenes who really run things. And so that's why this is very interesting, that these individuals will choose and pick and pluck individuals at an early stage in their careers and be sure that they're facilitated on up the ladder.
And because it's sort of like Barack Obama, there's always been a mysterious force behind Barack Obama that has pushed him into key positions at Harvard and then into the United States Senate. I mean, how would this young man who had never held a job other than as a community organizer working under Saul Alinsky's, Alinsky was dead, but of course he was using Alinsky's techniques, and Alinsky, of course, had dedicated his book, what was it, something for radicals, Rules for Radicals.
Rules for Radicals.
Right, to Lucifer. And so this man, you know, Barack Obama suddenly is a senator, and then he's suddenly the president of the United States, and just a couple of weeks before the November election last year, when John McCain was already gaining way, and Sarah Palin, even though they attacked her, she attracted a lot of support from the Christians in this country who do make up the majority and certainly the voting population, and suddenly the whole economy collapses, which of course shifted everything behind Barack Obama. It was almost as if the economy collapsed almost on as part of a plan. And now we have Barack Obama as the President of the United States. Well, go ahead, pick up the story. You were telling us about Bert Bennett.
He's one of these power elite individuals, like a David Rockefeller. This particular one is of the branch of the Royal Dutch Shell, House of Orange. It goes way back. I mean, the money to start the Bank of England came from the Bank of Amsterdam, very, very powerful globalist type entities here.
I think people have to understand there really is, of course, they call them the black nobility of Europe. They're the people who really rule things. The Queen of England, the Queen of the Netherlands, the King of Spain. The houses, the royalty, and where are they working? Why they're working in banking. That's, after all, that's where the money is. That's where you'd work. That's why bank robbers rob banks, because that's where the money is. And that's why these people work in the banks and organize the banks. That's where the money and the power is.
Sure. And the House of Orange and the Royal Dutch Shell combined with England and that royal family. Of course, you know, William and Mary were brought over there deliberately by,
Cromwell?
Temple, William Temple, back in the 1600s. William Temple was the John J. McCloy of the 1600s. he was that kind of guy, and I describe him in my book, Now's the Dawning of the New Age, New World Order, and he's the one that brought William and Mary over for this specific purpose, to get the Hanoverians in there, you know, George I, George II, George III, with the liberal Protestantism that we would now sort of say is almost like secular humanism and so forth. So way back, they've been plotting all this stuff. Plus, the Bank of Amsterdam gave the money to start the Bank of England so that they could continue that, get them in debt. As soon as the Bank of England was established, you know, within a few years, they had this huge debt, and there you go. You know, there you go again. Get the sovereigns in debt, and then you can pretty well control what they do. But anyway, in the House of Orange coming forward today, and, you know, Queen Juliana and Prince Bernard, of course, remember, you know, he founded the Bilderbergers, 1954, and he was an SS officer. Don't forget, I've written in a previous articles about the secret Nazi plan. Bernard was an SS officer. You know, you don't get to be an SS officer just because you want to. This is, you know, Heinrich Himmler, and they're dabbled into the occult, the SS as well. And, you know, on the one hand, we say, oh, look, you know, Himmler, horrible SS, but then you got a major in the SS like Werner von Braun. He comes over here, hooray for Werner, you know, let's give him all kinds of kudos and big money, big job, nice guy, right? He's an SS major, not a sergeant, a major. Well, forget all about that, you know, we'll applaud him now. And so Prince Bernard was one of those as well. And so the point bringing all this up is Bert Bennett is the Royal Dutch Shell person here in this country. And Charlie Rose is, you know, one of these from little old Henderson, North Carolina, who was sort of picked and plucked and facilitated, and he's introduced.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Go right ahead.
And so he's from this little town, and he's just picked out of nowhere and introduced to all of these movers and shakers, and winds up with his own PBS show, and, you know, can just sort of pretty well call up and say, "Hey, Henry Kissinger, want to be on? Okay." They're buddies, you know. And so that's the way this thing works. And so the reason I started all this digression was, if your listeners get onto PBS and get onto the Charlie Rose show, he archives the shows, and he had a couple of interesting segments this week. Tuesday was John Negroponte. And the reason I mentioned Negroponte, who had been director of national intelligence through, I guess, 2005 to 2007 under our previous President Bush, was toward the end of the Negroponte interview. He says, well, what Charlie's asking about Iran and Israel and the situation today. And Negroponte says, well, you know, about Iran and Israel, it may be just like it took a Nixon to open the door to communist China, it may be that a Benjamin Netanyahu can open the door to Iran. So here we're facing deja vu all over again. What you do is you get a person who's supposedly, you know, just like Ariel Sharon, supposedly was very right-wing and so forth, and now a lot of the people who are conservatives in Israel became disenchanted with him. Now you've got Benjamin Netanyahu, and here's Negroponte, who's sort of an agent, you know, he's an insider, saying, well, you know, a Democrat, a liberal, a Kennedy, whoever, they couldn't have opened the door to China, but Nixon could. Nixon could. And so apparently what's going to happen is, if Negroponte is sort of letting the cat out of the bag, is that everybody's going to say, hooray, we got Benjamin Netanyahu, but then, you know, let's wait and see. Let's wait and see. The plan may be that it would take somebody like him to make the compromises necessary for this, you know, elite plan to move forward between Iran and Middle East and Palestinians and Israelis and so forth and so on. And then the other interview that he had this week was, and you can get this on his archives, is with Kissinger and Brzezinski. Monday had both of them on there, and he would ask them about the situation today, whatever it was, didn't matter. And each of them would go back and forth, Kissinger, Brzezinski. And it was a very interesting interview as to what they went through all possibilities, various contingencies with Afghanistan, Pakistan, what might happen if Pakistan imploded and so forth. So your listeners, if they want to, they can log on to that, and they may see what the future will hold, because these guys oftentimes, before something happens, actually spill the beans and say, you know, okay, here's what's going to happen. And if you pay attention to what they say, sure enough, within a year or two, that's what happens.
Well, these are the architects that make this happen. I mean, certainly it was Brzezinski who was responsible for the Afghan war, for the formation of the Mujahideen, which became Al-Qaeda, and for the funding of the Taliban. He was the master architect of all of this. And then Kissinger, of course, is the master architect of prolonging the Vietnam War and the bombing of Cambodia, where 600,000 people were slaughtered there by American bombs. But never let him mention that here in the United States. In many place parts of the world, Henry Kissinger is looked upon as a war criminal. He's very careful traveling outside the United States for fear he will be arrested, because there are warrants. On my understanding, some countries have actually issued warrants for his arrest. But
that's right.
We never hear about that here in the United States. Henry Kissinger, certainly one of the most diabolical and dangerous people in the world today, certainly an agent of the Rockefeller family, moving us ever away from freedom towards one world government. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course Dr. Cuddy has just touched on the fact that Charlie Rose earlier this last week had on his program Henry Kissinger and Zygmunt Brzezinski. Now, there are only probably 150 members of the Bilderbergers, I should say of the Trilateral, by there are only 87 members of the Trilateral Commission who are actually American citizens, and three of them were on that program, Charlie Rose, Henry Kissinger, and Brzezinski. If you don't have a program, you can't tell who the players are. And here, Charlie Rose, a member of the Trilateral Commission, has two other members, two of the most powerful people in our country, both members of the Trilateral Commission, on his program to bring them before the American people. And perhaps, what was your impression? Did they give you any idea what really is going to happen in the future? Because these men will determine it.
Yeah, they did.
And what did they basically say?
Well, they got into what would happen in Afghanistan and Pakistan and whether or not there would be an implosion and the various risk. You have to understand and interpret what they're saying. They won't come out and say, you know, in 2 years from now, Pakistan will fall to the Taliban elements and Al-Qaeda. They don't do like that. What they do is they go back and forth discussing what they consider risk. They'll say, well, there's a risk. And so as soon as you hear them talk about the word risk, then whatever comes after the risk is probably what's going to happen. Because they always like to have, what I call, the paralegal likes to have plausible deniability. They don't want anybody to be able to say, well, you guys made this happen.
Well, of course, these guys did make it happen. People have forgotten that the largest financier of the Taliban at the time of the September 11th, 2001 attack was the United States. Now, for the listener out there, George Bush gave a speech. It was either the 20th or the 21st of September. It was a speech to the nation. You can pull it down. Where he said the United States is the largest source of income and funding for humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. Well, at that time, that was the Taliban. So we were financing them. And we've continued financing them. We give money to Pakistan. The Pakistani give money to their ISI, their intelligence. The intelligence gives to the Pakistan, to the Taliban. The Taliban kill our boys in Afghanistan. That's how we keep the war going. If we weren't funding it, we wouldn't have an enemy. It takes a lot of money to create a force like the Taliban. American tax dollars at work. Go right ahead, Dennis.
Sure. And back in the 90s, the future envoy to Afghanistan and then representative ambassador to Iraq was Zalmay Khalilzad, who was a lobbyist for the Taliban there at that time. And, yeah, Kissinger was a protege of Nelson Rockefeller, that particular wing of the Rockefeller family. And then, of course, in terms of what he did with the Vietnam War and so forth, you have to remember what General Al Haig said that Kissinger mentioned to him, and that was that soldiers were simply dumb animals to be used in the furtherance of foreign policy. And that's the way the elite looks at everybody, not just soldiers, us. You know, we are dumb animals to be used as well and manipulated.
I think anybody would like to check that reference. That comes from the final days, I think it is, there by Woodward and Bernstein, about page 96. But if you want the exact quote page, we'll send it to you. You know, the American soldiers, just stupid, dumb animals to be used for foreign policy. That's the way they look upon us, the elite. I mean, Henry Kissinger, the man who's giving orders every day to James Jones, who's the director of the National Security Council, who's director of national security in the Obama administration. Go right ahead.
Sure. And so that's the way the elite looks at all of us. You know, they're into breeding. You'll always see they're always breeding either, you know, roses or horses or something like that. And that's why they get into this whole genetic engineering today. That's why they would fund Hitler and the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute over there. And Hitler, I mean, Hitler was, you know, Johnny come lately to this stuff. He got a lot of his ideas from these various entities over here, whether it's Carnegie Foundation or Institute or the Rockefeller Foundation. And they would get a lot of their funds from these people because they were furthering that that element. A lot of our big names, the first, I think, international conference on eugenics in 1912, I think it was, you had people, you know, Calvin Coolidge, Charles Eliot, head of Harvard, I think Winston Churchill was a vice president. All of these, you know, big names, elitists, were involved in that stuff. Now, you know, it got a bad rap under Hitler, so they temporarily softened their approach, but they never stopped their approach. In fact, some of them, like Sir Julian Huxley, would just go on. I mean, in his 1948 book, UNESCO, Its Purpose and Philosophy, or Philosophy and Purpose, whatever it is, he was the first director general. And, you know, Hitler's just like two or three years gone, and the world is still, you know, sort of shaky, and he comes out in that book and says, well, you know what we need? We need a world government. We need to start thinking about eugenics.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And, of course, will God bless America ever again? We have two governments. We have the apparent government that, with duly elected representatives, but we have an invisible government made up of the Charlie Roses and the Henry Kissingers and the Zbigniew Brzezinskis, a small little cabal that controls both political parties and makes mockery out of the electoral process. They have a different agenda. Because I believe they worship, at least many of them worship, a different god. But you go right ahead, Dennis.
And that word you mentioned, cabal, is not something imaginary. That's David Rockefeller quote on page 405 of his book, Memoirs, where he says some people have said that me and my family are part of a secret cabal conspiring against the best interest of the United States in order to have a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. And his very next sentence is, if that's the charge, I stand guilty and I'm proud of it. So even Rockefeller himself uses the term secret cabal and conspiring. So that's, you know, they come out in the open. That's why people say, well, is this a conspiracy? They say, no. it's out, it's no secret anymore. It's out in the open. Unless you want to say it's like the open conspiracy, which was the title of H.G. Wells' 1928 book, Blueprints for World Revolution. So you could say it's an open conspiracy, but to the extent that people think conspiracies are hidden, this is not that anymore. They're right in your face. Right in your face. What are you going to do about it? And of course, you know, the press just covers it up. They've had 7 years to talk about this really remarkable, shocking quote of Rockefeller in his 2002 book, Memoirs. But you haven't seen it. I mentioned last time, I think that there was a long, long book review in the New York Times by the supposed conservative David Brooks. Nowhere in that interview, I mean, in that book review, will you find a mention of that quote by Rockefeller. Nowhere. And so, you know, they don't care anymore. The public is just going along, and that's the way it is. All right, back to the note that I had at the first of the article, What is the Role of Iran? I had mentioned about Russia and China, and then Secretary of the Treasury Geithner in the London Telegraph article talking about him saying they would consider this a new global currency, and that column in the London Telegraph said, but the seeds of doubt have been sown, and now is the dawning of the New Age New World Order book that I had that came out in 1991 that I mentioned before in this interview.
Hold that thought right there, Dennis. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and of course, Dr. Cuddy is a frequent guest here. You can read his articles at newswithviews.com almost on a weekly basis. And we're talking certainly about this whole idea that the Timothy Geithner, member of the Trilateral Commission, Council on Foreign Relations, Bilderberger, Group of 30, certainly he came from Kissinger and Associates, former, here's a guy who's about 43 years of age. He's the president of the Federal Reserve Branch Bank of New York, where he worked very closely with Henry Paulson, you know, to try to address the crisis. And then, of course, he replaces Henry Paulson, you know, as the Secretary of the Treasury. I mean, what are his qualifications? Absolutely nothing. He can't even do his own income tax right. He cheated on $30,000 or $40,000 worth of his income tax, but that's all right. Like he's a nice person. There's nobody in the entire country who could do a better job than Timothy Geithner. And yet, recently he had made the statement that certainly he was not adverse to the idea of the dollar being replaced as the reserve currency for the world, which of course would mean the demise of our our monetary system. Trillions of these dollars flooding home. These not real dollars, they're all credit, but it would simply destroy the value of probably 50 to 75% of everything that every one of our listeners has. Timothy Geithner makes that statement in public, and then the next day, well, the Treasury Department says, oh, well, he really didn't mean that, you know. Well, the dollar is going to be the reserve currency for a long time. And I got news for you. I think he did mean it. I think that they're going to replace the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. We're coming up with another currency, and that's going to have a devastating impact on our economy. And, of course, if you think that the job loss figures have been high these last few months, you just wait. You haven't seen anything. If you think the foreclosure rate has been astronomical and it's coming to an end, why, you've been reading the wrong publications. Go ahead, Dr. Cuddy.
Okay, so what I talked about just before the last break was that in my book back in 1991 called Now's the Dawning of the New Age, New World Order, I put in there a mention of the Economist magazine, that's in London, a respected economics journal magazine, January 9, 1988, and it showed a picture of the Phoenix as the global currency planned for the year 2018 A.D. It said pencil in the Phoenix for that year because it projected that in 1988 that it would take about 30 years to get to this point. Of course, they may be a little ahead of the time schedule, or they may decide to have these regional currencies, the euro and so forth, and we may wind up with an Amero, and what they may do is have a basket of these currencies. You know, they're not just a currency right off the bat, but they may combine these regional currencies or have a basket of them that can be used depending upon the region that you're in. But the point is, as this London Telegraph said, the seeds of doubt have been sown because they are going to have this global currency. If you're going to have a world government, you've got to have a world currency, and so that's the plan through this economic venue. They will coerce these things to happen. You have to have a crisis, right? I mean, people just don't automatically say, oh, well, let's junk the dollar and go with the Phoenix. So you have to have a crisis. That's what we have to get people to accept this. And so this is the current situation that we have today. And on ABC's Evening News just a few days ago, about a week ago, April 2, Charles Gibson was on there, and he said to Fred Bergston, Bergson's with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. This is Charles Gibson. He says this, quote, "It was extraordinary to hear the British Prime Minister and the French President at the end of this," that's the G20 meeting, "almost suggesting that this represents a new world order. Does it? Question mark." As Charles Gibson of ABC's World News Tonight. And Bergson replies, quote, "In a very important sense, it does represent a new world order. The G20 includes 5 countries from the Americas, 5 from Asia, 5 from Europe, and 5 from elsewhere. It's the true globalization of economic decision-making," end quote. That was Bergson. Now, Bergson also noted that the G20 meeting, quote, "tells our country and our people that the world crisis is being effectively responded to by global policy," end quote. And so my statement right after that in my article is, I say, "and establishing, quote, global policy is the first step in the power elite's establishment of a world socialist government." Now, moving on in my note to another subject, I said the Obama administration has announced its desire eventually to abolish all nuclear weapons in the world. All right, now, assuming Obama has any intelligence at all, why would he want to return to the days, I'm asking this, of World War II, where an evil aggressor like Hitler can invade other nations without fear of any serious immediate consequences? Why would he want to do that? Think of an Asia, for example, where an expansionist communist China, ruled by dictators, as it is, decides to be aggressive, let's say, against Taiwan. And imagine that they don't mind, which they don't, losing millions of their own people, because they already have 1.3 billion of them. They think they have too many anyway. And the only weapons that could be used against them, this huge army, would be conventional weapons that can inflict only limited damage over a period of time. Imagine that situation. Also think of a of a sparsely populated nation like Israel, with only conventional weapons to use against hostile surrounding nations with very large populations and armies. Now, just think about that and then answer this question. Doesn't Obama's desired world free of nuclear weapons make possible the Book of Revelation's reference to Iraq's Euphrates River drying up? That's what it says, the Euphrates will dry up, making way for a massive ground assault from the east in the Battle of Armageddon. That's what it says. I believe it's chapter 16 in Revelations. But only could that type of thing happen if you had this Obama-desired, fanciful world with no nuclear weapons used as a deterrent. I mean, otherwise, Israel would say, okay, here's 200 million man army coming from the east against us. Well, we'll just drop a few nukes on them. So only can this happen, this massive invasion from the east across the dried-up Euphrates against Israel, if there are no nuclear weapons. So, here we go. Obama's right down the path to the Book of Revelation. And, it's unbelievable that anybody could say there should be. I mean, of course you don't like nuclear weapons. Nobody likes the nuclear bomb on Hiroshima and so on. No, but that's not the point. The point is, if you abolish all of them, if we have no nuclear defense, then we have literally returned to the days of Hitler, where you have these conventional weapons slaughtering, people all over the place year after year after year. We're back to the old scenario. And when you get back to that old scenario, then if you have a country, a huge country of 1.3 billion people who believes there's no God, and who cares if we lose 300 million in a war, that's an invitation to them to take aggressive action. That's what it is.
It's not only that, but the analogy of what is happening today and what happened prior to Adolf Hitler, because as you well know, why it was American corporations working over there in Germany that built the weapons for Adolf Hitler. And you have a copy of my letter I found from Ambassador Dodd to Colonel House back in 1936, saying, why are these American corporations building all these weapons? He can't get any money out of the country, but they're building the weapons for the German army, and nobody wants a war over there. How can we stop this? Well, of course, right now, of course, our government's been doing everything they could to subsidize, to encourage our corporations to move over to China, where they, of course, we've built their steel mills for them and their manufacturing, so they can build their weapons of war. We transferred the technology for their satellites, so they can target our cities. And then we're told why Bill Clinton did that, because he got a $100,000 campaign contribution. If he did that, he ought to go to prison for the rest of his life. What happened to him? Why, of course, when he got out of the presidency, why, he made $110 million in 10 years, but that was just a salary. He also got $492 million for his foundation. That's pretty good pay. So he can, of course, tap into that foundation if he wants to. So we're talking over $500 million given to Bill Clinton, the man who transferred the technology that allows the Chinese communists to target their missiles on our cities. What sort of madness is that? Why, it's almost as if we're doing everything we can to build China up in preparation for a massive war with the United States. Doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
Not from a logical perspective, but from the Paralese plan, of course, it makes perfect sense. Well, anyway, that's the end of the note at the beginning of the article. And then, the article, as I mentioned, is about what is the role of Iran. And I use as a jumping off point a new book by Mike Evans. It's titled, Jimmy Carter, The Liberal Left and World Chaos. Now, in this book, there's a lot of good information, some good quotes. Mike Evans does not have the perspective of this power elite that's overriding all of this stuff. So he's looking at it, in the usual us versus them sense of the word. But all in all, there's some good material in there, and it devotes a lot of attention to President Carter and Iran, because probably the takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran on November 4th of 1979 did as much as anything else. I mean, yes, there was stagflation domestically and so on, but that probably did as much as anything else to prevent the reelection of Carter as president. What most people don't realize is that these crises like that, like the takeover of our embassy, for example, these things are manipulated by the power elite to fulfill their ultimate plan for world socialist government. Now, I've written about certain members of the power elite, and we've talked about them many times in the past. David Rockefeller, we just mentioned. There's Cecil Rhodes with his Secret Society of the Elect. And so when you get to Jimmy Carter, it's very significant to note that two of his most significant foreign policy mentors were David Rockefeller and a Rhodes scholar. That's Hedley Donovan. He was editor-in-chief of Time. At that time, he had been with Newsweek and other places before, but at that time, the Rhodes scholar Hedley Donovan was editor-in-chief of Time. And they had a meeting with Jimmy Carter in London, sort of feel him out, sort of like I mentioned Burt Bennett before, calling somebody to him, you know, to come up and get his blessing or not. And so right after that, Rockefeller says, okay, we're going to name Carter as the Democratic gubernatorial representative to the Trilateral Commission, which Rockefeller had just begun in 1973. And according to a book, well, the book is edited by Holly Sklar. The book is called Trilateralism, the Trilateral Commission, and the Elite Planning for World Management. And within that book, she's the editor, she has a number of articles. One is by Lawrence Shoup, S-H-O-U-P. And in there, Shoup is saying that this membership on the Trilateral Commission actually assured Jimmy Carter of favorable press coverage. You know, like if Hedley Donovan is editor-in-chief of Time, he's going to get good coverage there and so forth. So it assures him of favorable press coverage in his run for the presidency in 1976. Now, once Carter became president, once again, you have to look for the Rhodes Scholar and all this stuff. He Carter, selects Rhodes Scholar Stansfield Turner as head of the CIA. Now, according to Mike Evans in this book, he interviewed Iran's leader, he interviewed his wife, Farah Pahlavi. Mohammad Reza, they called him the Shah of Iran. Pahlavi believed that the CIA was really behind the unrest in his country during that time of the Carter administration. And why would he do that? Well, he knew perfectly well that it was the CIA as well as the British under something called Operation Ajax, which in August of 1953 had helped revolutionaries depose their elected leader at that time, Mohammad Mossadegh, and installed the Shah himself. But it wasn't just they had this revolution, let's install the Shah. They had to also have the cooperation of the Ayatollah at the time, and that the person was Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Qasim Kashani. And then as Kashani gets older, he has a person he's mentoring, and that's Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. And this is the one who will come to power when the Shah is invited to leave. And so what a lot of people don't understand is that Khomeini had British connections. Remember, Cecil Rhodes, Secret Society, all that. So Khomeini has British connections, and therefore it was not by accident the BBC, a British Broadcasting Corporation, opposed the Shah. And what they would do, for example, is every time there was a rally against the Shah, they would be sure and send it out over their signal going over Iran as to when the rally was. You know, so all, you know, every Tom, Dick, and Muhammad could show up at the rally to oppose the Shah. So it looked like this great big popular uprising that was facilitated by the British. And so Evans, the author of this book about Jimmy Carter, relates that Iran expert, one of them named Yuri Lubrani, told him, the American ambassador to Iran during this critical period, 1977 to 79, was a William Sullivan. And Lubrani told him that Sullivan, quote, had little experience in Iran and was very much reliant on Tony Parsons, the British ambassador, end quote. So what you really have is the American ambassador, Sullivan, is being run by the British ambassador, Tony Parsons. And Parsons attended Oxford University's Balliol College in 1949, and of course, that name Balliol is familiar to those who are familiar with Cecil Rhodes, because Reginald Balliol Brett was one of the three individuals closest to Rhodes in his, as Lord Esher, in his Secret Society of the Elect, which Rhodes said was, quote, to take the government of the whole world, end quote. And in an interview with Evans on March 28th of last year, just, you know, March 28th, just a year ago, Farah Pahlavi, that's the wife of the Shah, said Mrs. Ferdinand Marcos sent her a message, that's Vara Pahlavi, saying, quote, Marcos, that's her husband, Marcos told me to tell you that wherever Sullivan goes, he creates a revolution, end quote. So Sullivan is put in that position for that purpose, for that purpose. He's going to create this revolution there, just like we had a revolution back in 1953 when the Shah was placed into power by our government.
Well, I think it's more should be very telling to the American people if they understood that it was the American government and the CIA that brought the radical mullahs to power. People say, oh, well, it was just a mistake. I don't think we make mistakes. We're pretty smart there. We needed an enemy, and boy, the Iranians were a great enemy. We had trained the Shah's secret police, and they became the secret police for the mullahs. And, of course, then they eventually create Hezbollah, and they're going to bomb the American embassy in Beirut. They're going to blow up the Marine barracks there. And according to the book, Seen of Evil, by Robert Baer, we knew ahead of time that these attacks were coming. And what did the intelligence agency do to stop the killing of all those Marines there and the barracks and the people in the embassy? They didn't try to stop it. You have to ask yourself, why was that? They knew who did it. They knew it was coming. And we never did anything at all about Hezbollah. You have to ask yourself, why don't they occasionally make a mistake in our favor? And they don't make mistakes. They know exactly what they're doing. They just can't let the American people understand that there's a grand chessboard out there, and they're using our people as pawns in this. A lot of them get killed, but they don't care, because the real aim is a one-world government and a one-world religion, and the destruction of Christianity. Well, Dennis, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Well, what I'm going to do is, I was going to continue this article, but given what you said, what I'm going to do is give you, your listeners, a preview of my next column, which will be part four of this. And the reason is what you had just said, you know, why don't they make a mistake in our favor? And so one of the things I'm going to put in this next article is directly bears on what you just said. And this is a quote from page 7 of Senator Joseph McCarthy's book called The Fight for America, 1952. This is a quote from page 7. He's talking about Jim Forrestal, who was Secretary of the Navy at that time in the late 40s. And now this is McCarthy's writing, quote, "Before meeting Jim Forrestal, I thought we were losing to international communism because of incompetence and stupidity on the part of our planners. I mentioned that to Forrestal. I shall forever remember his answer. He said, quote, McCarthy, consistency has never been a mark of stupidity. If they were merely stupid, they would occasionally make a mistake in our favor, end quote. And then McCarthy says, this phrase struck me so forcefully that I have often used it since, in period.
And, Chris, wasn't Jim Forrestal the fellow who just sort of accidentally fell out of a window at Bethesda Hospital?
Yeah, I think it was Bethesda. And you recall Nixon later, when they were going to have him have some operation in Bethesda, he said, I'm not going into Bethesda. If I go in there, I'll never come out alive.
Right. Well, of course, Joe McCarthy did go into Bethesda, and he never came out alive.
Same thing with Auchincloss, who was the secretary, Colonel House's granddaughter. She was secretary to one of the Rockefellers, and then she started blabbing about where all our gold went. Next thing you knew, she accidentally fell out of, I think it was the 6th or 10th floor of her apartment building. You know, these accidental falling out of buildings, these accidental suicides are very coincidental.
You don't want to stand down there on the street, you know, below their windows when they're there.
You know? No.
Because, ladies and gentlemen, we have a great new four CD set called Deadly Assassins, and you're actually going to hear the interviews with some of these assassins. The man who was assigned to kill Ross Perot, the man who was assigned to kill the prince of Cambodia, Sihanouk. Well, we're out of time, Dennis. We could go on, but we'll really look forward to having him with us again next week as we explore more of these amazing things that are going on. Will we still be on the subject of Iran?
Yes.
All right, fine. We're really going to look forward to it. Thank you so very much for being with us, and it's always loads of fun. Bye-bye.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. And, of course, our listening audience, I hope you've enjoyed our interview with Dr. Dennis Cuddy. A wonderful source of information. I hope he's making you think. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris, off the air, incidentally, we do talk during the breaks. And if you'd like to get the complete tapes, CDs, they are available through Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. We were talking about so many prominent people who die under very mysterious circumstances. I mentioned we've got a great new 4-CD set. It's called Deadly Assassins. Just completed it now, and you'll hear an interview with a man who was assigned the job of killing Ross Perot. He refused to do it, so, of course, he got into real trouble. In fact, we're told that his body recently washed up on one of the beaches in the Caribbean, where he'd been hiding all these many years since he failed to carry out his assignment to kill Ross Perot. You'll hear interviews with other professional assassins or people talking about the assassinations. And then, of course, we have another 4-tape set on the execution of Martin Luther King, people who attended the trial, where, of course, they put on, it was a 4-week trial. It was sponsored by Martin Luther King's family. My interviews with a lawyer that the family hired to bring the suit against Lloyd Jowers, who was part of the conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King. And the jury said, yes, the government was behind it, and not a word in the media. You need to get this 4-tape set, the execution of Martin Luther King. We've got great new information on Bobby Kennedy. We carry the book, Target Patton, how they killed General Patton, because, of course, he wanted to go after the communists, and he was going to come home and reveal the fact that they had intentionally prolonged the Second World War, and so many of our boys were killed because of that. They could never let General Patton come home and leave the military and tell the American people the truth. That's why we had to kill him. The book, Target Patton, and in that 4-tape set on assassination, you'll hear my interview with the author of that book. Got a great book on RFK Must Die. We've got a DVD by that title. I think the book is called Who Killed Bobby Kennedy, or Who Killed Bobby. We have a 4-tape set on the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. You can get the Bobby Kennedy special with the book, the DVD, and, of course, the 4-tape set. The information is available from Radio Liberty you will not get elsewhere. Why? Because the media is controlled in the United States, ladies and gentlemen. And, for instance, most people have never heard about the 600,000 Cambodians who died as a result of the American bombing during the Vietnam War. 600,000 Cambodian innocent people living in their little huts with the thatch roofs were murdered by American bombers. Does this reflect on America? No, it reflects on Henry Kissinger, who was in charge at that time, who intensely prolonged the Vietnam War. But if you want information, you can look it up on the Internet. I checked it out. We have the article that recently appeared in the London Guardian about this. But you're never going to hear this through the media any more than you're going to hear about the Great Hunger, the intentional murder of between 30 and 43 million Chinese, between 58 and 62. Look these things up. Try to prove me wrong. Go on the Internet. We are so fortunate to have the Internet today, where you can actually get the information we never could get out before because of the control of the media. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. If you haven't read the book by Professor Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, Tragedy and Hope, where he tells about how it was the English who were backing Adolf Hitler before the Second World War, or certainly Professor Quigley's wonderful book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. These books are available, as with so many other, from Radio Liberty. But behind them are the powerful spiritual forces. That's why my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, my talk, Forbidden Secret, and the syllabus that goes with that, or the Secret Mystery 3-DVD set, The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, Riddles in Stone, and the latest one, which you have to get, The Eye of the Phoenix, tells you about the emblems on the back of the dollar bill and the man who put them there. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. From the mountain.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.